Precht, making the same mistake, refused to treat Paul and Bill as criminally kidnapped Americans. Whether Abolfath Mahfi was corrupt or not, the fact was that he had not made a penny out of EDS's contract with the ministry. Indeed, EDS had got into trouble in its early days for refusing to give Mahfi a piece of the action. It happened like this. Mahfi helped EDS get its first small contract in Iran, creating a document control system for the Iranian Navy. EDS, advised that by law they had to have a local partner, promised Mahfi a third of the profit. When the contract was completed 2 years later, EDS duly paid Mahfi $400,000. But while the ministry contract was being negotiated, Mahfi was on the blacklist. Nevertheless, when the deal was about to be signed, Mahfi, who by this time was off the blacklist again, demanded that the contract be given to a joint company owned by him and EDS. EDS refused. While Mahfi had earned his share of the Navy contract, he had done nothing for the ministry deal. Mahfi claimed that EDS's association with him had smoothed the way for the ministry contract through the 24 different government bodies that had to approve it. Furthermore, he said, he had helped obtain a tax ruling favorable to EDS that was written into the contract. EDS only got the ruling because Mahfi had spent time with the Ministry of Finance in Monte Carlo. EDS had not asked for his help and did not believe that he had given it. Furthermore, Ross Perot did not like the kind of help that takes place in Monte Carlo. EDS's Iranian attorney complained to the Prime Minister, and Mahfi was carpeted for demanding bribes. Nevertheless, his influence was so great that the Ministry of Health would not sign the contract unless EDS made him happy. EDS had a series of stormy negotiations with Mahfi. EDS still refused point-blank to share profits with him. In the end, there was a face-saving compromise. A joint company, acting as a subcontractor to EDS, would recruit and employ all EDS's Iranian staff. In fact, the joint company never made money, but that was later. At the time, Mahfi accepted the compromise, and the ministry contract was signed. So EDS had not paid bribes, and the Iranian government knew it. But Henry Precht did not, nor did Lew Gulse. Consequently, their attitude to Paul and Bill was equivocal. Both men spent many hours on the case, but neither gave it top priority. When EDS's combative lawyer, Tom Luce, talked to them as if they were idle or stupid or both, they became indignant and said they might do better if he would get off their backs. Precht in Washington and Gulse in Tehran were the crucial ground-level operatives dealing with the case. Neither of them was idle. Neither was incompetent. But they both made mistakes. They both became somewhat hostile to EDS. And in those vital first few days, they both failed to help Paul and Bill.
Chapter 3. A guard opened the cell door, looked around, pointed at Paul and Bill, and beckoned them. Bill's hopes soared. Now they would be released. They got up and followed the guard upstairs. It was good to see daylight through the windows. They went out the door and across the courtyard to the little one-story building beside the entrance gate. The fresh air tasted heavenly. It had been a terrible night. Bill had lain on the thin mattress, dozing fitfully, startled by the slightest movement from the other prisoners, looking around anxiously in the dim light from the all-night bulb. He had known it was morning when a guard came with glasses of tea and rough hunks of bread for breakfast. He had not felt hungry. He had said a rosary. Now it seemed his prayers were being answered. Inside the one-story building was a visiting room furnished with simple tables and chairs. Two people were waiting. Bill recognized one of them. It was Ali Jordan, the Iranian who worked with Lew Gulse at the embassy. He shook hands and introduced his colleague, Bob Sorensen. "We brought you some stuff," Jordan said. "A battery shaver, you'll have to share it, and some dungarees." Bill looked at Paul. Paul was staring at the two embassy men, looking as if he were about to explode.
"Aren't you going to get us out of here?" Paul said.
"I'm afraid we can't do that."
"God damn it, you got us in here!"
Bill sat down slowly, too depressed to be angry. "We're very sorry this has happened," said Jordan. "It came as a complete surprise to us. We were told that Dadgar was favorably disposed toward you. The embassy is filing a very serious protest."
But what are you doing to get us out?"
"You must work through the Iranian legal system. Your attorneys..."
"Jesus Christ," Paul said disgustedly.
Jordan said, "We have asked them to move you to a better part of the jail."
"Gee, thanks."
Sorensen asked, "Is there anything else you need?"
"There's nothing I need," Paul said. "I'm not planning to be here very long."
Bill said, "I'd like to get some eye drops."
"I'll see that you do," Sorensen promised.
Jordan said, "I think that's all for now." He looked at the guard. Bill stood up. Jordan spoke in Farsi to the guard, who motioned Paul and Bill to the door. They followed the guard back across the courtyard. Jordan and Sorensen were low-ranking embassy staff, Bill reflected. Why hadn't Gulse come? It seemed that the embassy thought it was EDS's job to get them out. Sending Jordan and Sorensen was a way of notifying the Iranians that the embassy was concerned, but at the same time letting Paul and Bill know that they could not expect much help from the U.S. government. We're a problem the embassy wants to ignore, Bill thought angrily. Inside the main building, the guard opened a door they had not been through before, and they went from the reception area into a corridor. On their right were three offices. On their left were windows looking out into the courtyard. They came to another door, this one made of thick steel. The guard unlocked it and ushered them through. The first thing Bill saw was a TV set. As he looked around, he started to feel a little better. This part of the jail was more civilized than the basement. It was relatively clean and light, with gray walls and gray carpeting. The cell doors were open, and the prisoners were walking around freely. Daylight came in through the windows. They continued along a hall with two cells on the right and on the left what appeared to be a bathroom. Bill looked forward to a chance to get clean again after his night downstairs. Glancing through the last door on the right, he saw shelves of books. Then the guard turned left and led them down a long, narrow corridor and into the last cell. There they saw someone they knew. It was Reza Nehabat, the deputy minister in charge of the Social Security Organization at the Ministry of Health. Both Paul and Bill knew him well and had worked closely with him before his arrest last September. They shook hands enthusiastically. Bill was relieved to see a familiar face and someone who spoke English. Nehabat was astonished.
"Why are you in here?"
Paul shrugged. "I kind of hoped you might be able to tell us that."
"What are you accused of?"
"Nothing," said Paul. "We were interrogated yesterday by Mr. Dadgar, the magistrate who's investigating your former minister, Dr. Sheikh. He arrested us. No charges, no accusations. We are supposed to be material witnesses, we understand." Bill looked around. On either side of the cell were paired stacks of bunks, three high, with another pair beside the window, making 18 altogether. As in the cell downstairs, the bunks were furnished with thin foam rubber mattresses, the bottom bunk of the three being no more than a mattress on the floor, and gray wool blankets. However, here some of the prisoners seemed to have sheets as well. The window opposite the door looked out onto the courtyard. Bill could see grass, flowers, and trees, as well as parked cars belonging, he presumed, to guards. He could also see the low building where they had just talked with Jordan and Sorensen. Nehabat introduced Paul and Bill to their cellmates, who seemed friendly and a good deal less villainous than the inmates of the basement. There were several free bunks. The cell was not as crowded as the one downstairs, and Paul and Bill took beds on either side of the doorway. Bill's was the middle bunk of three, but Paul was on the floor again. Nehabat showed them around. Next to their cell was a kitchen, with tables and chairs, where the prisoners could make tea and coffee or just sit and talk. For some reason, it was called the Chattanooga Room. Beside it was a hatch in the wall at the end of the corridor. This was a commissary, Nehabat explained, where from time to time you could buy soap, towels, and cigarettes. Walking back down the long corridor, they passed their own cell, number five, and two more cells before emerging into the hall, which stretched away to their right. The room Bill had glanced into earlier turned out to be a combination guard's office and library, with books in English as well as Farsi. Next to it were two more cells. Opposite these cells was the bathroom with sinks, showers, and toilets. The toilets were Persian style, like a shower tray with a drain hole in the middle. Bill learned he was not likely to get the shower he longed for. Normally, there was no hot water. Beyond the steel door, Nehabat said, was a little office used by a visiting doctor and dentist. The library was always open, and the TV was on all evening, although, of course, programs were in Farsi. Twice a week, the prisoners in this section were taken out into the courtyard to exercise by walking in a circle for half an hour. Shaving was compulsory. The guards would allow mustaches, but not beards. During the tour, they met two more people they knew. One was Dr. Toliati, the ministry data processing consultant about whom Dadgar had questioned them. The other was Hussein Pasha, who had been Nehabat's financial man at the Social Security Organization. Paul and Bill shaved with the electric razor brought in by Sorensen and Jordan. Then it was noon and time for lunch. In the corridor wall was an alcove screened by a curtain. From there, the prisoners took a linoleum mat, which they spread on the cell floor, and some cheap tableware. The meal was steamed rice with a little lamb, plus bread and yogurt, and tea or Pepsi-Cola to drink. They sat cross-legged on the floor to eat. For Paul and Bill, both gourmets, it was a poor lunch. However, Bill found he had an appetite. Perhaps it was the cleaner surroundings. After lunch, they had more visitors, their Iranian attorneys. The lawyers did not know why they had been arrested, did not know what would happen next, and did not know what they could do to help. It was a desultory, depressing conversation. Paul and Bill had no faith in them anyway, for it was these lawyers who had advised Lloyd Briggs that the bail would not exceed $20,000. They returned no wiser and no happier. They spent the rest of the afternoon in the Chattanooga room, talking to Nehabat, Toliati, and Pasha. Paul described his interrogation by Dadgar in detail. Each of the Iranians was highly interested in any mention of his own name during the interrogation. Paul told Dr. Toliati how his name had come up in connection with a suggested conflict of interest. Toliati described how he, too, had been questioned by Dadgar in the same way before being thrown in jail. Paul recollected that Dadgar had asked about a memorandum written by Pasha. It had been a completely routine request for statistics, and nobody could figure out what was supposed to be special about it. Nehabat had a theory as to why they were all in jail. The Shah is making scapegoats of us to show the masses that he really is cracking down on corruption. But he picked a project where there was no corruption. There is nothing to crack down on. But if he releases us, he will look weak. If he had looked instead at the construction business, he would have found an unbelievable amount of corruption. It was all very vague. Nehabat was just rationalizing. Paul and Bill wanted specifics. Who ordered the crackdown? Why pick on the Ministry of Health? What kind of corruption was supposed to have taken place? And where were the informants who had put the finger on the individuals who were now in jail? Nehabat was not being evasive. He simply had no answers. His vagueness was characteristically Persian. Ask an Iranian what he had for breakfast, and 10 seconds later, he would be explaining his philosophy of life. At 6 o'clock, they returned to their cell for supper. It was pretty grim, no more than the leftovers from lunch mashed into a dip to be spread on bread with more tea. After supper, they watched TV. Nehabat translated the news. The Shah had asked an opposition leader, Shapur Bakhtiar, to form a civilian government replacing the generals who had ruled Iran since November. Nehabat explained that Shapur was leader of the Bakhtiar tribe and that he had always refused to have anything to do with the regime of the Shah. Nevertheless, whether Bakhtiar's government could end the turmoil would depend on the Ayatollah Khomeini. The Shah had also denied rumors that he was leaving the country. Bill thought this sounded encouraging. With Bakhtiar as prime minister, the Shah would remain and ensure stability, but the rebels would at last have a voice in governing their own country. At 10 o'clock, the TV went off, and the prisoners returned to their cells. The other inmates hung towels and pieces of cloth across their bunks to keep out the light. Here as downstairs, the bulb would shine all night. Nehabat said Paul and Bill could get their visitors to bring in sheets and towels for them. Bill wrapped himself in the thin gray blanket and settled down to try to sleep. "We're here for a while," he thought resignedly. "We must make the best of it. Our fate is in the hands of others."
Their fate was in the hands of Ross Perot, and in the next 2 days all his high hopes came to nothing. At first the news had been good. Kissinger had called back on Friday, December 29th, to say that Artasir Zahedi would get Paul and Bill released. First, though, U.S. Embassy officials had to hold 2 meetings, one with people from the Ministry of Justice, the other with representatives of the Shah's court. In Tehran, the American ambassador's deputy, Minister Counselor Charles Nass, was personally setting up those meetings. In Washington, Henry Precht at the State Department was also talking to Artasir Zahedi. Emily Gaylord's brother-in-law, Tim Reardon, had spoken to Senator Kennedy. Admiral Moore was working his contacts with the Iranian military government. The only disappointment in Washington had been Richard Helms, the former U.S. ambassador to Tehran. He had said candidly that his old friends no longer had any influence. EDS consulted 3 separate Iranian lawyers. One was an American who specialized in representing U.S. corporations in Tehran. The other 2 were Iranians. One had good contacts in pro-Shah circles. The other was close to the dissidents. All 3 had agreed that the way Paul and Bill had been jailed was highly irregular and that the bail was astronomical. The American, John Westberg, had said that the highest bail he had ever heard of in Iran was $100,000. The implication was that the magistrate who had jailed Paul and Bill was on weak ground. Here in Dallas, EDS's chief financial officer, Tom Walter, the slow-talking Alabaman, was working on how EDS might, if necessary, go about posting bail of $12,750,000. The lawyers had advised him that bail could be in one of 3 forms: cash, a letter of credit drawn on an Iranian bank, or a lien on property in Iran. EDS had no property worth that much in Tehran. The computers actually belonged to the ministry. And with the Iranian banks on strike and the country in turmoil, it was not possible to send in $13 million in cash. So Walter was organizing a letter of credit. T.J. Marcus, whose job it was to represent EDS in the investment community, had warned Perot that it might not be legal for a public company to pay that much money in what amounted to ransom. Perot deftly sidestepped that problem. He would pay the money personally. Perot had been optimistic that he would get Paul and Bill out of jail in 1 of the 3 ways: legal pressure, political pressure, or by paying the bail. Then the bad news started coming in. The Iranian lawyers changed their tune. In turn, they reported that the case was political, had a high political content, and was a political hot potato. John Westberg, the American, had been asked by his Iranian partners not to handle the case because it would bring the firm into disfavor with powerful people. Evidently, examining magistrate Hossein Dadgar was not on weak ground. Lawyer Tom Luce and financial officer Tom Walter had gone to Washington and, accompanied by Admiral Moore, had visited the State Department. They had expected to sit down around a table with Henry Precht and formulate an aggressive campaign for the release of Paul and Bill. But Henry Precht was cool. He had shaken hands with them. He could hardly do less when they were accompanied by a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But he had not sat down with them. He had handed them over to a subordinate. The subordinate reported that none of the State Department's efforts had achieved anything. Neither Ardeshir Zahedi nor Charlie Nass had been able to get Paul and Bill released. Tom Luce, who did not have the patience of Job, got mad as hell. It was the State Department's job to protect Americans abroad, he said, and so far all State had done was to get Paul and Bill thrown in jail. Not so, he was told. What State had done so far was above and beyond its normal duty. If Americans abroad committed crimes, they were subject to foreign laws. The State Department's duties did not include springing people from jail. But, Luce argued, Paul and Bill had not committed a crime. They were being held hostage for $13 million. He was wasting his breath. He and Tom Walter returned to Dallas empty-handed. Late last night, Perot had called the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and asked Charles Nass why he still had not met with the officials named by Kissinger and Zahedi. The answer was simple. Those officials were making themselves unavailable to Nass. Today, Perot had called Kissinger again and reported this. Kissinger was sorry. He did not think there was anything more he could do. However, he would call Zahedi and try again. One more piece of bad news completed the picture. Tom Walter had been trying to establish with the Iranian lawyers the conditions under which Paul and Bill might be released on bail. For example, would they have to promise to return to Iran for further questioning if required, or could they be interrogated outside the country? Neither, he was told. If they were released from prison, they still would not be able to leave Iran.
Now it was New Year's Eve. For 3 days, Perot had been living at the office, sleeping on the floor and eating cheese sandwiches. There was nobody to go home to. Margot and the children were still in Vail. And because of the 9.5-hour time difference between Texas and Iran, important phone calls were often made in the middle of the night. He was leaving the office only to visit his mother, who was now out of the hospital and recuperating at her Dallas home. Even with her, he talked about Paul and Bill. She was keenly interested in the progress of events. This evening, he felt the need of hot food, and he decided to brave the weather. Dallas was suffering an ice storm, and drive a mile or so to a fish restaurant. He left the building by the back door and got behind the wheel of the station wagon. Margot had a Jaguar, but Perot preferred nondescript cars. He wondered just how much influence Kissinger had now, in Iran or anywhere. Zahedi and any other Iranian contacts Kissinger had might be like Richard Helms's friends, all out of the mainstream, powerless. The Shah seemed to be hanging on by the skin of his teeth. On the other hand, that whole group might soon need friends in America and might welcome the opportunity to do Kissinger a favor. While he was eating, Perot felt a large hand on his shoulder, and a deep voice said, "Ross, what are you doing here, eating all by yourself on New Year's Eve?" He turned around to see Roger Staubach, quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys, a fellow Naval Academy graduate and an old friend. "Hi, Roger, sit down." "I'm here with the family," Staubach said. "The heat's off in our house on account of the ice storm." "Well, bring them over." Staubach beckoned to his family, then said, "How's Margot?" "Fine, thank you. She's skiing with the children in Vail. I had to come back. We've got a big problem." He proceeded to tell the Staubach family all about Paul and Bill. He drove back to the office in good spirits. There were still a bunch of good people in the world. He thought again of Colonel Simons. Of all the schemes he had for getting Paul and Bill out, the jailbreak was the one with the longest lead time. Simons would need a team of men, a training period, equipment. And yet Perot still had not done anything about it. It had seemed such a distant possibility, a last resort. While negotiations had seemed promising, he had blocked it out of his mind. He was still not ready to call Simons. He would wait for Kissinger to have one more try with Zahedi. But perhaps there was something he could do to prepare for Simons. Back at EDS, he found Pat Scully. Scully, a West Point graduate, was a thin, boyish, restless man of 31. He had been a project manager in Tehran and had come out with a December 8 evacuation. He had returned after Ashura, then come out again when Paul and Bill were arrested. His job at the moment was to make sure that the Americans remaining in Tehran, Lloyd Briggs, Rich Gallagher and his wife, Paul and Bill, had reservations on a flight out every day, just in case the prisoners should be released. With Scully was Jay Coburn, who had organized the evacuation, and then on December 22nd had come home to spend Christmas with his family. Coburn had been about to go back to Tehran when he got the news that Paul and Bill had been arrested, so he'd stayed in Dallas and organized the second evacuation. A placid, stocky man, Coburn was 32, but looked 40. The reason, Perot believed, was that Coburn had lived 8 years in one as a combat helicopter pilot in Vietnam. For all that, Coburn smiled a lot, a slow smile that began as a twinkle in his eye and often ended in a shoulder-shaking belly laugh. Perot liked and trusted both men. They were what he called eagles, high flyers, who used their initiative, got the job done, gave him results, not excuses. The motto of EDS's recruiters was, "Eagles don't flock. You have to find them one at a time." One of the secrets of Perot's business success was his policy of going looking for men like this, rather than waiting and hoping they would apply for a job. Perot said to Scully, "Do you think we're doing everything we need to do for Paul and Bill?" Scully responded without hesitation, "No, I don't." Perot nodded. These young men were never afraid to speak out to the boss. That was one of the things that made them eagles. "What do you think we ought to do?" "We ought to break them out," Scully said. "I know it sounds strange, but I really think that if we don't, they have a good chance of getting killed in there." Perot did not think it sounded strange. That fear had been at the back of his mind for 3 days. "I'm thinking of the same thing." He saw surprise on Scully's face. "I want you two to put together a list of EDS people who could help do it. We'll need men who know Tehran, have some military experience, preferably in special forces type action, and are 100% trustworthy and loyal." "We'll get on it right away," Scully said enthusiastically. The phone rang and Coburn picked it up. "Hi, Keene. Where are you?" "Hold on a minute." Coburn covered the mouthpiece with his hand and looked at Perot. "Keene Taylor is in Frankfurt. If we're going to do something like this, he ought to be on the team." Perot nodded. Taylor, a former Marine sergeant, was another of his eagles. 6'2" and elegantly dressed, Taylor was a somewhat irritable man, which made him the ideal butt for practical jokes. Perot said, "Tell him to go back to Tehran, but don't explain why." A slow smile spread across Coburn's young old face. "He ain't gonna like it." Scully reached across the desk and switched on the speakers so they could all hear Taylor blow his cool. Coburn said, "Keene, Ross wants you to go back to Iran." "Well, what the hell for?" Taylor demanded. Coburn looked at Perot. Perot shook his head. Coburn said, "There's a lot we need to do, in terms of tidying up, administratively speaking. You tell Perot I'm not going back in there for any administrative bullshit." Scully started to laugh. Coburn said, "Keene, I have somebody else here who wants to talk to you." Perot said, "Keene, this is Ross." "Oh, hello, Ross. I'm sending you back to do something very important." "Oh? Do you understand what I'm saying?" There was a long pause, then Taylor said, "Yes, sir." "Good. I'm on my way." "What time is it there?" Perot asked. 7 o'clock in the morning." Perot looked at his own watch. It said midnight. 1979 had begun.
Taylor sat on the edge of the bed in his Frankfurt hotel room thinking about his wife. Mary was in Pittsburgh with the children, Mike and Dawn, staying at Taylor's brother's house. Taylor had called her from Tehran before leaving and told her he was coming home. She had been very happy to hear it. They had made plans for the future. They would return to Dallas, put the kids in school. Now he had to call and tell her he would not be coming home after all. She would be worried. Hell, he was worried. He thought about Tehran. He had not worked on the Ministry of Health project, but had been in charge of a smaller contract to computerize the old-fashioned manual bookkeeping systems of Bank Omran. One day, about 3 weeks ago, a mob had formed outside the bank. Omran was the Shah's bank. Taylor had sent his people home. He and Glenn Jackson were the last to leave. They locked up the building and started walking north. As they turned the corner onto the main street, they walked into the mob. At that moment, the army opened fire and charged down the street. Taylor and Jackson ducked into a doorway. Someone opened the door and yelled at them to get inside. They did. But before their rescuer could lock it again, four of the demonstrators forced their way in, chased by five soldiers. Taylor and Jackson flattened themselves against the wall and watched the soldiers, with their truncheons and rifles, beat up the demonstrators. One of the rebels made a break for it. Two of his fingers were almost torn off his hand, and blood spurted all over the glass door. He got out, but collapsed in the street. The soldiers dragged the other three demonstrators out. One was a bloody mess, but conscious. The other two were out, cold, or dead. Taylor and Jackson stayed inside until the street was clear. The Iranian, who had saved them, kept saying, "Get out while you can!" "And now," Taylor thought, "I have to tell Mary that I've just agreed to go back into all that. To do something very important." Obviously, it had to do with Paul and Bill, and if Perot could not talk about it on the phone, presumably it was something at least clandestine and quite possibly illegal. In a way, Taylor was glad, despite his fear of the mobs. While still in Tehran, he had talked on the phone with Bill's wife, Emily Gaylord, and had promised not to leave without Bill. The orders from Dallas that everyone but Briggs and Gallagher had to get out had forced him to break his word. Now the orders had changed, and perhaps he could keep his promise to Emily after all. Well, he thought, I can't walk back, so I'd better find a plane. He picked up the phone again.
Jay Coburn remembered the first time he had seen Ross Perot in action. He would never forget it as long as he lived. It happened in 1971. Coburn had been with EDS less than 2 years. He was a recruiter, working in New York City. Scott was born that year at a little Catholic hospital. It was a normal birth, and at first Scott appeared to be a normal, healthy baby. The day after he was born, when Coburn went to visit, Liz said Scott had not been brought in for his feeding that morning. At the time, Coburn took no notice. A few minutes later, a woman came in and said, "Here are the pictures of your baby." "I don't remember any pictures being taken," Liz said. The woman showed her the photographs. "No, that's not my baby." The woman looked confused for a moment, then said, "Oh, that's right. Yours is the one that's got the problem." It was the first Coburn and Liz had heard of any problem. Coburn went to see the day-old Scott and had a terrible shock. The baby was in an oxygen tent, gasping for air, and as blue as a pair of jeans. The doctors were in consultation about him. Liz became almost hysterical, and Coburn called their family doctor and asked him to come to the hospital. Then he waited. Something wasn't stacking up right. What kind of a hospital was it where they didn't tell you your newborn baby was dying? Coburn became distraught. He called Dallas and asked for his boss, Gary Griggs. "Gary, I don't know why I'm calling you, but I don't know what to do," and he explained. "Hold the phone," said Griggs. A moment later, there was an unfamiliar voice on the line. "Jay?" "Yes. This is Ross Perot." Coburn had met Perot 2 or 3 times, but had never worked directly for him. Coburn wondered whether Perot even remembered what he looked like. EDS had more than 1,000 employees at that time. "Hello, Ross." "Now, Jay, I need some information." Perot started asking questions. What was the address of the hospital? What were the doctors' names? What was their diagnosis? As he answered, Coburn was thinking bemusedly, "Does Perot even know who I am?" "Hold on a minute, Jay." There was a short silence. "I'm going to connect you with Dr. Urschel, a close friend of mine and a leading cardiac surgeon here in Dallas." A moment later, Coburn was answering more questions from the doctor. "Don't do a thing," Urschel finished. "I'm going to talk to the doctors on that staff. You just stay by the phone so we can get back in touch with you." "Yes, sir," said Coburn dazedly. Perot came back on the line. "Did you get all that? How's Liz doing?" Coburn thought, how the hell does he know my wife's name? "Not too well," Coburn answered. "Her doctor's here, and he's given her some sedation." While Perot was soothing Coburn, Dr. Urschel was animating the hospital staff. He persuaded them to move Scott to New York University Medical Center. Minutes later, Scott and Coburn were in an ambulance on the way to the city. They got stuck in a traffic jam in the Midtown Tunnel. Coburn got out of the ambulance, ran more than a mile to the toll gate, and persuaded an official to hold up all lanes of traffic except the one the ambulance was in. When they reached New York University Medical Center, there were 10 or 15 people waiting outside for them. Among them was the leading cardiovascular surgeon on the East Coast, who had been flown in from Boston in the time it had taken the ambulance to reach Manhattan. As baby Scott was rushed inside, Coburn handed over the envelope of x-rays he had brought with him from the other hospital. A woman doctor glanced at them. "Where are the rest?" "That's all," Coburn replied. "That's all they took?" New x-rays revealed that, as well as a hole in the heart, Scott had pneumonia. When the pneumonia was treated, the heart condition came under control, and Scott survived. He turned into a soccer-playing, tree-climbing, creek-wading, thoroughly healthy little boy. And Coburn began to understand the way people felt about Ross Perot. Perot's single-mindedness, his ability to focus narrowly on one thing and shut out distractions until he got the job done, had its disagreeable side. He could wound people. A day or two after Paul and Bill were arrested, he had walked into an office where Coburn was talking on the phone to Lloyd Briggs in Tehran. It had sounded to Perot as though Coburn was giving instructions, and Perot believed strongly that people in the head office should not give orders to those out there in the battlefield who knew the situation best. He had given Coburn a merciless telling off in front of a room full of people. Perot had other blind spots. When Coburn had worked in recruiting, each year the company had named someone Recruiter of the Year. The names of the winners were engraved on a plaque. The list went back years, and in time, some of the winners left the company. When that happened, Perot wanted to erase their names from the plaque. Coburn thought that was weird. So the guy left the company. So what? He had been Recruiter of the Year 1 year, and why try to change history?
It was almost as if Perrault took it as a personal insult that someone should want to work elsewhere. Perrault's faults were of a piece with his virtues. His peculiar attitude toward people who left the company was the obverse of his intense loyalty to his employees. His occasional unfeeling harshness was just part of the incredible energy and determination without which he would never have created EDS. Coburn found it easy to forgive Perrault's shortcomings. He had only to look at Scott.
"Mr. Perrault," Sally called, "it's Henry Kissinger." Perrault's heart missed a beat. Could Kissinger and Zahedi have done it in the last 24 hours? Or was he calling to say he had failed? "Ross Perrault, hold the line for Henry Kissinger, please." A moment later, Perrault heard the familiar guttural accent.
"Hello, Ross?"
"Yes." Perrault held his breath.
"I have been assured that your men will be released tomorrow at 10 a.m., Tehran time."
Perrault let out his breath in a long sigh of relief. "Dr. Kissinger, that's just about the best news I've heard since I don't know when. I can't thank you enough."
"The details are to be finalized today by U.S. Embassy officials and the Iranian Foreign Ministry, but this is a formality. I have been advised that your men will be released."
"It's just great. We sure appreciate your help."
"You're welcome."
It was 9:30 in the morning in Tehran, midnight in Dallas. Perrault sat in his office waiting. Most of his colleagues had gone home to sleep in bed for a change, happy in the knowledge that by the time they woke up, Paul and Bill would be free. Perrault was staying at the office to see it through to the end. In Tehran, Lloyd Briggs was at the Bucharest office, and one of the Iranian employees was outside the jail. As soon as Paul and Bill appeared, the Iranian would call Bucharest and Briggs would call Perrault. Now that the crisis was almost over, Perrault had time to wonder where he had gone wrong. One mistake occurred to him immediately. When he had decided on December 4 to evacuate all his staff from Iran, he had not been determined enough, and he'd let others drag their feet and raise objections until it was too late. But the big mistake had been doing business in Iran in the first place. With hindsight, he could see that. At the time, he had agreed with his marketing people, and with many other American businessmen, that oil-rich, stable, Western-oriented Iran presented excellent opportunities. He had not perceived the strains beneath the surface. He knew nothing about the Ayatollah Khomeini, and he had not foreseen that one day there would be a president naive enough to try to impose American beliefs and standards on a Middle Eastern country. He looked at his watch. It was 12:30. Paul and Bill should be walking out of that jail right now. Kissinger's good news had been confirmed by a phone call from David Newsom, Cy Vance's deputy at the State Department. And Paul and Bill were getting out not a moment too soon. The news from Iran had been bad again today. Bakhtiar, the Shah's new prime minister, had been rejected by the National Front, the party that was now seen as the moderate opposition. The Shah had announced that he might take a vacation. William Sullivan, the American ambassador, had advised the dependents of all Americans working in Iran to go home, and the embassies of Canada and Britain had followed suit. But the strike had closed the airport, and hundreds of women and children were stranded. However, Paul and Bill would not be stranded. Perrault had had good friends at the Pentagon ever since the POW campaign. Paul and Bill would be flown out on a U.S. Air Force jet. At 1 o'clock, Perrault called Tehran. There was no news. Well, he thought, everyone says the Iranians have no sense of time. The irony of this whole thing was that EDS had never paid bribes, in Iran or anywhere else. Perrault hated the idea of bribery. EDS's code of conduct was set out in a 12-page booklet given to every new employee. Perrault had written it himself. "Be aware that federal law and the laws of most states prohibit giving anything of value to a government official with the intent to influence any official act. Since the absence of such intent might be difficult to prove, neither money nor anything of value should be given to a federal, state, or foreign government official. A determination that a payment or practice is not forbidden by law does not conclude the analysis. It is always appropriate to make further inquiry into the ethics. Could you do business in complete trust with someone who acts the way you do? The answer must be yes." The last page of the booklet was a form that the employee had to sign, acknowledging that he had received and read the code. When EDS first went to Iran, Perrault's Puritan principles had been reinforced by the Lockheed scandal. Daniel J. Houghton, chairman of the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation, had admitted to a Senate committee that Lockheed routinely paid millions of dollars in bribes to sell its planes abroad. His testimony had been an embarrassing performance that disgusted Perrault. Wriggling on his seat, Houghton had told the committee that the payments were not bribes, but kickbacks. Subsequently, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act made it an offense under U.S. law to pay bribes in foreign countries. Perrault had called in lawyer Tom Luce and made him personally responsible for ensuring that EDS never paid bribes. During the negotiation of the Ministry of Health contract in Iran, Luce had offended not a few EDS executives by the thoroughness and persistence with which he had cross-examined them about the propriety of their dealings. Perrault was not hungry for business. He was already making millions. He did not need to expand abroad. If you have to pay bribes to do business there, he had said, why, we just won't do business there. His business principles were deeply ingrained. His ancestors were Frenchmen who came to New Orleans and set up trading posts along the Red River. His father, Gabriel Ross Perot, had been a cotton broker. The trade was seasonal, and Ross Sr. had spent a lot of time with his son, often talking about business. There's no point in buying cotton from a farmer once, he would say. You have to treat him fairly, earn his trust, and develop a relationship with him so that he'll be happy to sell you his cotton year after year. Then you're doing business. Bribery just did not fit in there. At 1:30, Perot called the EDS office in Tehran again. Still there was no news. Call the jail or send somebody down there, he said. Find out when they're getting out. He was beginning to feel uneasy. What will I do if this doesn't work out, he thought. If I put up the bail, I'll have spent $13 million and still Paul and Bill will be forbidden to leave Iran. Other ways of getting them out using the legal system came up against the obstacle raised by the Iranian lawyers, that the case was political, which seemed to mean that Paul's and Bill's innocence made no difference. But political pressure had failed so far. Neither the U.S. Embassy in Tehran nor the State Department in Washington had been able to help. And if Kissinger should fail, that would surely be the end of all hope in that area. What then was left? Force. The phone rang. Perot snatched up the receiver. Ross Perot. This is Lloyd Briggs. Are they out? No. Perot's heart sank. What's happening? We spoke to the jail. They have no instructions to release Paul and Bill. Perot closed his eyes. The worst had happened. Kissinger had failed. He sighed. Thank you, Lloyd. What do we do next? I don't know, said Perot. But he did know. He said goodbye to Briggs and hung up the phone. He would not admit defeat. Another of his father's principles had been, take care of the people who work for you. Perot could remember the whole family driving 12 miles on Sundays to visit an old black man who had used to mow their lawn, just to make sure that he was well and had enough to eat. Perot's father would employ people he did not need, just because they had no job. Every year, the Perot family car would go to the county fair crammed with black employees, each of whom was given a little money to spend and a Perot business card to show if anyone tried to give him a hard time. Perot could remember one who had ridden a freight train to California and, on being arrested for vagrancy, had shown Perot's father's business card. The sheriff had said, "We don't care whose nigger you are. We're throwing you in jail." But he had called Perot Sr., who had wired the train fare for the man to come back. "I've been to California, and I's back," the man said when he reached Texarkana, and Perot Sr. gave him back his job. Perot's father did not know what civil rights were. This was how you treated other human beings. Perot had not known his parents were unusual until he grew up. His father would not leave his employees in jail, nor would Perot. He picked up the phone. "Get T.J. Marquez." It was 2 o'clock in the morning, but T.J. would not be surprised. This was not the first time Perot had woken him up in the middle of the night, and it would not be the last. A sleepy voice said, "Hello? Tom, it doesn't look good." "Why?" "They haven't been released, and the jail says they aren't going to be." "Ah, damn. Conditions are getting worse over there. Did you see the news?" "I sure did." "Do you think it's time for Simons?" "Yeah, I think it is." "Do you have his number?" "No, but I can get it." "Call him," said Perot.
Bull Simons was going crazy. He was thinking of burning down his house. It was an old wood-frame bungalow, and it would go up like a pile of matchwood, and that would be the end of it. The place was a hell to him, but it was a hell he did not want to leave. For what made it hell was the bittersweet memory of the time when it had been heaven. Lucille had picked the place. She saw it advertised in a magazine, and together they had flown down from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to look it over. At Red Bay, in a dirt-poor part of the Florida Panhandle, the ramshackle house stood in 40 acres of rough timber. But there was a 2-acre lake with bass in it. Lucille had loved it. It was 1971, and time for Simons to retire. He had been a colonel for 10 years, and if the Suntie raid could not get him promoted to general, nothing would. The truth was, he did not fit in the general's club. He had always been a reserve officer. He had never been to a top military school, such as West Point. His methods were unconventional, and he was no good at going to Washington cocktail parties and kissing ass. He knew he was a goddamn fine soldier, and if that was not good enough, why, Art Simons was not good enough. So, he retired and did not regret it. He had passed the happiest years of his life here at Red Bay. All their married life, he and Lucille had endured periods of separation, sometimes as much as a year without seeing one another, during his tours in Vietnam, Laos, and Korea. From the moment he retired, they were together all day and all night, every day of the year. Simons raised hogs. He knew nothing about farming, but he got the information he needed out of books and built his own pens. Once the operation was underway, he found there was not much to do but feed the pigs and look at them. So he spent a lot of time fooling around with his collection of 150 guns, and eventually set up a little gunsmithing shop where he would repair his and his neighbor's weapons and load his own ammunition. Most days, he and Lucille would wander hand in hand through the woods and down to the lake, where they might catch a bass. In the evening, after supper, she would go to the bedroom as if she were preparing for a date, and come out later wearing a housecoat over her nightgown and a red ribbon tied in her dark, dark hair, and sit on his lap. Memories like these were breaking his heart. Even the boys had seemed to grow up at last during those golden years. Harry, the younger, had come home one day and said, "Dad, I've got a heroin habit and a cocaine habit, and I need your help." Simons knew little about drugs. He had smoked marijuana once in a doctor's office in Panama before giving his men a talk on drugs, just so he could tell them he knew what it was like. But all he knew about heroin was that it killed people. Still, he had been able to help Harry by keeping him busy out in the open, building hog pens. It had taken a while. Many times, Harry left the house and went into town to score dope, but he always came back, and eventually he did not go into town anymore. The episode had brought Simons and Harry together again. Simons would never be close to Bruce, his elder son, but at least he had been able to stop worrying about the boy. Boy, he was in his 30s, and just about as bullheaded as, well, as his father. Bruce had found Jesus and was determined to bring the rest of the world to the Lord, starting with Colonel Simons. Simons had practically thrown him out. However, unlike Bruce's other youthful enthusiasms, drugs, I Ching, back-to-nature communes, Jesus had lasted. And at least Bruce had settled down to a stable way of life as pastor of a tiny church in the frozen northwest of Canada. Anyway, Simons was through agonizing about the boys. He had brought them up as well as he could, for better or worse, and now they were men and had to take care of themselves. He was taking care of Lucille. She was a tall, handsome, statuesque woman with a penchant for big hats. She looked pretty damn impressive behind the wheel of their black Cadillac, but in fact she was the reverse of formidable. She was soft, easygoing, and lovable. The daughter of two teachers, she had needed someone to make decisions for her, someone she could follow blindly and trust completely. And she had found what she needed in Art Simons. He, in turn, was devoted to her. By the time he retired, they'd been married for 30 years, and in all that time, he had never been in the least interested in another woman. Only his job, with its overseas postings, had come between them, and now that was over. He had told her, "My retirement plans can be summed up in one word, you." They had 7 wonderful years. Lucille died of cancer on March 16, 1978, and Bull Simons went to pieces. Every man has a breaking point, they said. Simons thought the rule did not apply to him. Now he knew it did. Lucille's death broke him. He had killed many people and seen more die, but he had not understood the meaning of death until now. For 37 years they had been together, and now suddenly, she just wasn't there. Without her, he did not see what life was supposed to be about. There was no point in anything. He was 60 years old, and he could not think of a single goddamn reason for living another day. He stopped taking care of himself. He ate cold food from cans and let his hair, which had always been so short, grow long. He fed the hogs religiously at 3:45 p.m. every day, although he knew perfectly well that it hardly mattered what time of day you fed a pig. He started taking in stray dogs, and soon had 13 of them scratching the furniture and messing on the floor. He knew he was close to losing his mind, and only the iron self-discipline that had been part of his character for so long enabled him to retain his sanity. When he first thought of burning the place down, he knew his judgment was unbalanced, and he promised himself he would wait a year and see how he felt then. His brother Stanley was worried about him, he knew. Stan had tried to get him to pull himself together, had suggested he give some lectures, had even tried to get him to join the Israeli army. Simons was Jewish by ancestry, but thought of himself as American. He did not want to go to Israel. He could not pull himself together. It was as much as he could do to live from day to day. He did not need someone to take care of him. He had never needed that. On the contrary, he needed someone to take care of. That was what he had done all his life. He had taken care of Lucille. He had taken care of the men under his command. Nobody could rescue him from his depression. For his role in life was to rescue others. That was why he had been reconciled with Harry, but not with Bruce. Harry had come to him, asking to be rescued from his heroin habit. But Bruce had come, offering to rescue Art Simons by bringing him to the Lord. In military operations, Simon's aim had always been to bring all his men back alive. The Sun Tai raid would have been the perfect climax to his career, if only there had been prisoners in the camp to rescue. Paradoxically, the only way to rescue Simons was to ask him to rescue someone else. It happened at 2 o'clock in the morning on January 2nd, 1979. The phone woke him. Will Simons? The voice was vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
This is T.J. Marcus from EDS in Dallas. Simons remembered EDS, Ross Perot, the POW campaign, the San Francisco party.
Hello, Tom.
Bull, I'm sorry to wake you.
It's okay. What can I do for you?
We have two people in jail in Iran. It looks like we may not be able to get them out by any conventional means. Would you be willing to help us?
Would he be willing? Hell yes, Simons said. When do we start?
Chapter 4. Ross Perot drove out of EDS and turned left on Forest Lane, then right on Central Expressway. He was heading for the Hilton Inn on Central and Mockingbird. He was about to ask seven men to risk their lives. Scully and Coburn had made their list. Their own names were at the top, followed by five more. How many American corporate chiefs in the 20th century had asked seven employees to perpetrate a jailbreak? Probably none. During the night, Coburn and Scully had called the other five, who were scattered all over the United States, staying with friends and relations after their hasty departure from Tehran. Each had been told only that Perot wanted to see him in Dallas today. They were used to midnight phone calls and sudden summonses. That was Perot's style, and they had all agreed to come. As they arrived in Dallas, they had been steered away from EDS headquarters and sent to check in at the Hilton Inn. Most of them should be there by now, waiting for Perot. He wondered what they would say when he told them he wanted them to go back to Tehran and bust Paul and Bill out of jail. They were good men and loyal to him, but loyalty to an employer did not normally extend to risking your life. Some of them might feel that the whole idea of a rescue by violence was foolhardy. Others would think of their wives and children, and for their sakes refuse, quite reasonably. I have no right to ask these men to do this, he thought. I must take care not to put any pressure on them. No salesmanship today, Perot, just straight talk. They must understand that they're free to say, no thanks, boss, count me out. How many of them would volunteer? One in five, Perot guessed. If that were the case, it would take several days to get a team together, and he might end up with people who did not know Tehran. What if none volunteered? He pulled into the parking lot of the Hilton Inn and switched off the engine.
Jay Coburn looked around. There were four other men in the room: Pat Scully, Glenn Jackson, Ralph Boulware, and Joe Pouché. Two more were on their way. Jim Schwaback was coming from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and Ron Davis from Columbus, Ohio. The Dirty Dozen they were not. In their business suits, white shirts and sober ties, with their short haircuts and clean-shaven faces and well-fed bodies, they looked like what they were, ordinary American business executives. It was hard to see them as a squad of mercenaries. Coburn and Scully had made separate lists, but these five men had been on both. Each had worked in Tehran, most had been on Coburn's evacuation team. Each had either military experience or some relevant skill. Each was a man Coburn trusted completely. While Scully was calling them in the early hours of this morning, Coburn had gone to the personnel files and put together a folder on each man, detailing his age, height, weight, marital status, and knowledge of Tehran. As they arrived in Dallas, each of them completed another sheet recounting his military experience, military schools attended, weapons training, and other special skills. The folders were for Colonel Simons, who was on his way from Red Bay. But before Simons arrived, Perot had to ask these men whether they were willing to volunteer. For Perot's meeting with them, Coburn had taken three adjoining rooms. Only the middle room would be used. The rooms on either side had been rented as a precaution against eavesdroppers. It was all rather melodramatic. Coburn studied the others, wondering what they were thinking. They still had not been told what this was all about, but they had probably guessed. He could not tell what Joe Pouché was thinking. Nobody ever could. A short, quiet man of 32, Pouché kept his emotions locked away. His voice was always low and even, his face generally blank. He had spent 6 years in the Army and had seen action as commander of a howitzer battery in Vietnam. He had fired just about every weapon the Army possessed up to some level of proficiency and had killed time in Vietnam practicing with a .45. He had spent 2 years with EDS in Tehran, first designing the enrollment system, the computer program that listed the names of people eligible for health care benefits, and later as the programmer responsible for loading the files that made up the database for the whole system. Coburn knew him to be a deliberate, logical thinker, a man who would not give his assent to any idea or plan until he had questioned it from all angles and thought out all its consequences slowly and carefully. Humor and intuition were not among his strengths. Brains and patience were. Ralph Bulwire was a full 5 inches taller than Pochet. One of the two black men on the list, he had a chubby face and small darting eyes and talked very fast. He had spent 9 years in the Air Force as a technician, working on the complex inboard computer and radar systems of bombers. In Tehran, for only 9 months, he had started as data preparation manager and had swiftly been promoted to data center manager. Coburn knew him well and liked him a lot. In Tehran, they had got drunk together. Their children had played together, and their wives had become friends. Bulwire loved his family, loved his friends, loved his job, loved his life. He enjoyed living more than anyone else Coburn could think of, with the possible exception of Ross Perot. Bulwire was also a highly independent-minded son of a gun. He never had any trouble speaking out. Like many successful black men, he was a shade oversensitive and liked to make it clear he was not to be pushed around. In Tehran, over Ashura, when he had been in the high-stakes poker game with Coburn and Paul, everyone else had slept in the house for safety, as previously agreed. But Bulwire had not. There had been no discussion, no announcement. Bulwire just went home. A few days later, he had decided that the work he was doing in Tehran did not justify the risk to his safety, so he returned to the States. He was not a man to run with the pack, just because it was a pack. If he thought the pack was running the wrong way, he would leave it. He was the most skeptical of the group assembling at the Hilton Inn. If anyone was going to pour scorn on the idea of a jailbreak, Bulwire would. Glenn Jackson looked less like a mercenary than any of them. A mild man with spectacles, he had no military experience, but he was an enthusiastic hunter and an expert shot. He knew Tehran well, having worked there for Bell Helicopter as well as for EDS. He was such a straight, forthright, honest guy, Coburn thought, that it was hard to imagine him getting involved in the deception and violence that a jailbreak would entail. Jackson was also a Baptist. The others were Catholic, except for Pochet, who did not say what he was, and Baptists were famous for punching Bibles, not faces. Coburn wondered how Jackson would make out. He had a similar concern about Pat Scully. Scully had a good military record. He had been 5 years in the Army, ending up as a Ranger instructor with the rank of captain, but he had no combat experience. Aggressive and outgoing in business, he was one of EDS's brightest up-and-coming young executives. Like Coburn, Scully was an irrepressible optimist, but whereas Coburn's attitudes had been tempered by war, Scully was youthfully naive. If this thing gets violent, Coburn wondered, will Scully be hard enough to handle it? Of the two men who had not yet arrived, one was the most qualified to take part in a jailbreak, and the other perhaps the least. Jim Schwebach knew more about combat than he did about computers. 11 years in the Army, he had served with the 5th Special Forces Group in Vietnam, doing the kind of commando work Bull Simon specialized in, clandestine operations behind enemy lines. And he had even more medals than Coburn. Because he had spent so many years in the military, he was still a low-level executive despite his age, which was 35. He had been a trainee systems engineer when he went to Tehran, but he was mature and dependable, and Coburn had made him a team leader during the evacuation. Only 5'6", Schwebach had the erect, chin-up posture of many short men, and the indomitable fighting spirit that is the only defense of the smallest boy in class. No matter what the score, it could be 12-0, 9th inning, and 2 outs, Schwebach would be up on the edge of the dugout, clawing away, trying to figure out how to get an extra hit. Coburn admired him for volunteering, out of high-principled patriotism, for extra tours in Vietnam. In battle, Coburn thought, Schwebach would be the last guy you would want to take prisoner. If you had your druthers, you would make sure you killed the little son of a bitch before you captured him. He would make so much trouble. However, Schwebach's feistiness was not immediately apparent. He was a very ordinary-looking fellow. In fact, you hardly noticed him. In Tehran, he had lived farther south than anyone else, in a district where there were no other Americans. Yet he had often walked around the streets wearing a beat-up old field jacket, blue jeans, and a knit cap, and had never been bothered. He could lose himself in a crowd of two, a talent that might be useful in a jailbreak. The other missing man was Ron Davis. At 30, he was the youngest on the list. The son of a poor black insurance salesman, Davis had risen fast in the white world of corporate America. Few people who started as he had in operations had ever made it to management on the customer side of the business. Perot was especially proud of Davis. Ron's career achievement is like a moonshot, he would say. Davis had acquired a good knowledge of Farsi in a year and a half in Tehran, working under Keen Taylor, not on the ministry contract, but on a smaller, separate project to computerize Bank Omran, the Shah's bank. Davis was cheerful, flippant, full of jokes, a juvenile version of Richard Pryor, but without the profanity. Coburn thought he was the most sincere of the men on the list. Davis found it easy to open up and talk about his feelings and his personal life. For that reason, Coburn thought of him as vulnerable. On the other hand, perhaps the ability to talk honestly about yourself to others was a sign of great inner confidence and strength. Whatever the truth about Davis's emotional toughness, physically he was as hard as a nail. He had no military experience, but he was a karate black belt. One time in Tehran, three men had attacked him and attempted to rob him. He had beaten them all up in a few seconds. Like Schwabach's ability to be inconspicuous, Davis's karate was a talent that might become useful. Like Coburn, all six men were in their 30s. They were all married, and they all had children. The door opened, and Perot walked in. He shook hands, saying, "How are you? And good to see you." As if he really meant it, remembering the names of their wives and children. He's good with people, Coburn thought. "Schwabach and Davis didn't get here yet," Coburn told him. "All right," Perot said, sitting down. "I'll have to see them later. Send them into my office as soon as they arrive." He paused. "I'll tell them exactly what I'm going to tell y'all." He paused again, as if gathering his thoughts. Then he frowned and looked hard at them. "I'm asking for volunteers for a project that might involve loss of life. At this stage, I can't tell you what it's about, although you can probably guess. I want you to take 5 or 10 minutes, or more, to think about it, and then come back to talk to me one at a time. Think hard. If you choose, for any reason, not to get involved, you can just say so, and no one outside this room will ever know about it. If you decide to volunteer, I'll tell you more. Now go away and think." They all stood up, and one by one, they left the room. I could get killed on the Central Expressway, thought Joe Pache. He knew perfectly well what the dangerous project was. They were going to get Paul and Bill out of jail. He had suspected as much since 2:30 a.m., when he had been woken up at his mother-in-law's house in San Antonio by a phone call from Pat Scully. Scully, the world's worst liar, had said, "Ross asked me to call you. He wants you to come to Dallas in the morning to begin work on a study in Europe." Pache had said, "Pat, why in hell are you calling me at 2:30 in the morning to tell me that Ross wants me to work on a study in Europe? It is kind of important. We need to know when you can be here." "Okay," Pache thought resignedly. "It's something you can't talk about on the phone. My first flight is probably around 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning." "Fine." Pache had made a plane reservation, then gone back to bed. As he set his alarm clock for 5 a.m., he said to his wife, "I don't know what this is all about, but I wish somebody would be straight just for once." In fact, he had a pretty good idea what it was all about, and his suspicions had been confirmed later in the day when Ralph Boulware had met him at the Coit Road bus station and, instead of taking him to EDS, had driven him to this hotel and refused to talk about what was going on. Pache liked to think everything through, and he had had plenty of time to consider the idea of busting Paul and Bill out of jail. It made him glad, glad as hell. It reminded him of the old days when there were only 3,000 people in the whole of EDS, and they had talked about the faith. It was their word for a whole bunch of attitudes and beliefs about how a company ought to deal with its employees. What it boiled down to was, EDS took care of its people. As long as you were giving your maximum effort to the company, it would stand by you through thick and thin, when you were sick, when you had personal or family problems, when you got yourself into any kind of trouble. It was a bit like a family. Pache felt good about that, although he did not talk about the feeling. He did not talk much about any of his feelings. EDS had changed since those days. With 10,000 people instead of 3,000, the family atmosphere could not be so intense. Nobody talked about the faith anymore, but it was still there. This meeting proved it. And although his face was as expressionless as ever, Joe Pache was glad. Of course they would go in there and bust their friends out of jail. Pache was just happy to get the chance to be on the team. Contrary to Coburn's expectation, Ralph Boulware did not pour scorn on the idea of a rescue. The skeptical, independent-minded Boulware was as hot for the idea as anyone. He, too, had guessed what was going on, helped, like Pache, by Scully's inability to lie convincingly. Boulware and his family were staying with friends in Dallas. On New Year's Day, Boulware had been doing nothing much, and his wife had asked him why he did not go to the office. He said there was nothing for him to do there. She did not buy that. Mary Boulware was the only person in the world who could bully Ralph, and in the end, he went to the office. There he ran into Scully. "What's happening?" Boulware had asked. "Oh, nothing," Scully said. "What are you doing?" "Making plane reservations, mostly." Scully's mood seemed strange. Boulware knew him well. In Tehran, they had ridden to work together in the mornings, and his instinct told him Scully was not telling the truth. "Something's wrong," Boulware said. "What's going on?" "There's nothing going on, Ralph." "What are they doing about Paul and Bill?" "They're going through all the channels to try and get them out.
The bail is $13 million, and we have to get the money into the country. Bullshit! The whole government system, the whole judicial system is broken down over there. There ain't no channels left. What are you all going to do? Look, don't worry about it. You guys ain't going to try and go in and get them out, are you? Scully said nothing. Hey, count me in, Boulware said. What do you mean, count you in? It's obvious you're going to try to do something. What do you mean? Let's don't play games anymore. Count me in. Okay. For him, it was a simple decision. Paul and Bill were his friends, and it could as easily have been Boulware in jail, in which case he would have wanted his friends to come and get him out. There was another factor. Boulware was enormously fond of Pat Scully. Hell, he loved Scully. He also felt very protective toward him. In Boulware's opinion, Scully really did not understand that the world was full of corruption and crime and sin. He saw what he wanted to see, a chicken in every pot, a Chevrolet on every driveway, a world of mom and apple pie. If Scully was going to be involved in a jailbreak, he would need Boulware to take care of him. It was an odd feeling to have about another man, more or less your own age, but there it was. That was what Boulware had thought on New Year's Day, and he felt the same today. So he went back into the hotel room and said to Perot what he had said to Scully. Count me in. Glenn Jackson was not afraid to die. He knew what was going to happen after death, and he had no fears. When the Lord wanted to call him home, why, he was ready to go. However, he was concerned about his family. They had just been evacuated from Iran and were now staying in his mother's house in East Texas. He had not yet had time even to start looking for a place for them all to live. If he got involved in this, he was not going to have time to go off and take care of family matters. It would be left to Carolyn. All on her own, she would have to rebuild the